Matter of Mirza Blur versus the Office of the Attorney General et al. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Zuckerman from the Office of the Attorney General on behalf of the petitioner.
Good morning. Good morning. Henel Patel from the New Jersey Institute for Social Justice on behalf of AMICI Civil Rights Organizations.
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Michioni, Kingston Coventry LLC on behalf of the plaintiff respondents Mirza M. Valour, Engelbert Ribeiro, and Andre Singh.
Good morning, Your Honors. Edward J. Florio, Florio Kenny Ravel, on behalf of the mayor of Patterson, Andre Saya.
Good morning, Your Honors. Vito Gagliardi from the firm of Porzio, Bromberg & Newman on behalf of AMICUS New Jersey State Association of Chiefs of Police.
And just to be clear, I only have Mr. Remiccioni and Mr. Gagliardi arguing on this side of the aisle.
I'm here for...
You're welcome to join us at the table. All right. Mr. Zuckerman, please go ahead.
Good morning again, Your Honors. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve just a few minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. May it please the court. This is a case about legislative intent. And here, all sources confirm that our legislature intended for an attorney general to be able to supersede a police department when circumstances warrant. I want to lay out the four main sources of evidence confirming this authority, and then dive into whatever questions would be most helpful to this court. First, the text and structure of the Criminal Justice Act of 1970 provides the foundation for this action, just as it did for previous supersessions. The CJA establishes a chain of command for law enforcement in our state, starting with the local police, running through the county prosecutor, and extending to the Attorney General as chief law enforcement officer of the state. It gives the Attorney General multiple tools to effectuate its goals, from the power to issue binding directives to the ability to directly supervise any or all of a department's work when appropriate. And it imposes on local police a corresponding duty to comply. Second, longstanding practice confirms our reading of the CJA's text and structure. Indeed, six former attorneys general have confirmed that was their understanding in an amicus brief. We have compiled examples of at least 17 supersessions of municipal police departments led by county prosecutors who plainly shared that view, and numerous lower court opinions acknowledge this authority as well. Third, the purpose of the CJA reinforces that text, structure, and history. The CJA exists to restore public confidence in the justice system and to advance the uniform and efficient administration of criminal justice throughout our state. Both logic and experience show that supersession is a necessary tool to serving those goals, and the broad recognition that this authority exists has long enabled state and county leaders to step in when action is needed, most prominently in Camden some two decades ago. Fourth, even if this court had questions about any of those sources, more recent legislative action conclusively resolved this case. After hearing testimony about this supersession, our legislature enacted Chapter 94. That act is predicated entirely on the existence of an AG supersession of a police department in a city of Patterson's size. It would therefore have zero real-world applications if the Attorney General lacked such authority. Moreover, far from questioning this authority, the legislature in Chapter 94 took steps to facilitate this supersession, making it easier for the Attorney General to designate an officer in charge hired from out of state, and making the act retroactive to the month this supersession began. And were that not enough, the legislature repeatedly appropriated millions of dollars directly to the Office of the Attorney General, specifically to fund this supersession. Put simply, our legislature has provided unusually striking evidence, not only that it understood and intended for supersessions like this one to be lawful, but also that it was working with the executive branch to help this very supersession succeed. That is fatal to the challenger's position. To be clear, we are not asking for a blank check. We have acknowledged throughout this litigation that arbitrary and capricious review exists for any cases in which an attorney general or a county prosecutor supersedes on an irrational or an invidious basis, and we embrace the role of courts in serving as a check if such hypotheticals ever come to pass. But no one has ever argued that this supersession was arbitrary or capricious, nor could they. As amici explain, and as the attorney general found, it was desperately needed. The panel below misconstrued the sources of evidence just described and overlooked the overwhelming proof of legislative intent they collectively provide. This court should reverse that legal error and confirm that attorneys general, like county prosecutors, can supersede police departments when the circumstances warrant. I welcome this court's questions.
Zuckerman, you referenced this in your opening, the legislative appropriations. I just wanted to ask you to confirm something or perhaps provide a little bit more detail. In the appendix are the appropriations handbooks that Treasury prepares, which list these allocations of millions of dollars. Was that information approved before? Was it before the legislature and approved by the legislature as opposed to the use of discretionary funds by the Attorney General?
Yes. So the legislature heard testimony about this very supersession. The Budget Committee heard a testimony from the Attorney General directly about this supersession, explaining why funding was needed to LPS, to the Office of the Attorney General specifically, to fund this supersession to ensure that it could succeed.
Now, the budget is a document that has a lot of pages to it. Were these allocations before the legislature in the form of that document, that proposal?
So, Your Honor, if I'm understanding your question correctly, my understanding is that what the legislature has allocated was exactly the $10 million in state court, in state costs for the Patterson supersession. If I'm understanding right, I think the answer is yes. But again, I would have to go back. I'm not an expert on our budget process, so I don't want to inadvertently lead you astray. So I can check on that and come back maybe with more information on rebuttal. But my understanding is that they were aware when they allocated this $10 million, they'd heard testimony specifically about this supersession asking for this exact allocation for this very supersession. So they repeatedly allocated that money. And you have the declaration from Kristen Sleeper in our petitioner's appendix, which talks about exactly how much money has been allocated, what it's meant for. There's about, at the time, there was over 7 million had been spent, about 3.5 encumbered or allocated for other costs directly for this supersession.
Yes, the record is clear from the certifications and other information that the money was going for that purpose. I just want, if you can clarify and rebuttal the legislature's approval of that would be helpful.
Let me ask you something about the fourth prong of your argument, which is about subsequent events evincing legislative intent. How does that square with what I thought was a principle of legislative intent, that the later state, that each legislature is in and of itself a body of specific legislators, and that what later legislators may comment about with respect to what an earlier legislature's intent was should be disregarded because the only issue is what the intent of the legislature was at the time of the enactment. So at the time of the supersession here, it really was a matter of CJA, not subsequent legislative acts. Why should we look at what happened later as evidence of what the intent of the framers of the CJA was?
So I think two primary reasons. I think the first one is about legislative intent as this court has instructed we think about legislative intent, because this court has rightly, I think, directed the lower courts many times that when you're trying to figure out what the legislature meant at a certain time, you can look at other sources of evidence, including subsequent legislation, because each legislature is also presumed to be familiar with its own prior enactments. So we cite the case St. Peter's University Hospital versus Lacey, that's 185 NJ1. And I think pages 14 through 18 explain very, very clearly how you do that exact type of legislative analysis. There you had a question about what did they mean at time zero when they passed a law that made it seem like every hospital might need a certificate of need. And then there was a later law that said, well, we're going to have Robert Wood Johnson and St. Peter's established as acute care facilities in Middlesex County. And St. Peter's basically said, well, Robert Wood Johnson still needs a certificate of need. And the Department of Health said no. And this court said the Department of Health was right. It affirmed that decision because it looked at both sources of legislation to try to figure out what the first legislature meant, because that second legislature is actually very, very good evidence of what that first legislature meant, because they're presumed to understand what the first one meant and to be very, very good evidence of it. Now, the second thing
tell me if I'm wrong, does that extend so far as to say, let's say they're, apart from this situation, let's say the legislature does two really different things over a period of 5 years on different occasions, and there's maybe a change in who's there. Wouldn't principles of statutory construction instruct us to look at, if we're talking about what was done on X date earlier, to look at the statements of legislators who were in the legislature at that time, were about the meaning of that that particular provision, rather than say later a bunch of people have said this is what it really meant or it didn't mean. And that's, with all due respect to the legislature, they're not the ones who passed that law. See what I'm saying? I thought that was a principle of statutory interpretation that we would follow.
So, Justice Patterson, I do think that all of these are principles of statutory interpretation that you use. Our point is not that you wouldn't also think about contemporaneous evidence from the passage of a law. That is one source of evidence in any case where a court is trying to figure out what did these legislators mean when they passed this law. But this court has also been clear that there are other sources that can also be really probative. And Lacey tells you that one source is subsequent legislation. Again, I don't think it's, I read this case in Lacey, this court in Lacey, to say that it's a presumption. It's not absolutely dispositive. You presume
the later. Would we apply that if there's no ambiguity?
So I think you would apply that. I think it can be helpful in understanding that there is ambiguity in the first place, potentially. If the legislature itself found it ambiguous or seemed to believe that the reading was one way, that's really, really strong evidence that it was not very obviously the other way, because even the legislature itself obviously thought.
If there's plain language, and we over and over have said this, if there's plain text that answers the question, I'm not suggesting you're wrong about the CJA here, but we would generally not go to any extrinsic evidence. And wouldn't extrinsic evidence include later legislators' statements or appropriations or later things that were done that would be irrelevant if the plain language of the CJA answers the question, as you argue that it does?
So I do agree this court has said many times that when the text is clear, you don't usually need to get to extrinsic sources of evidence. And I do agree that often subsequent legislation qualifies as an extrinsic source of evidence, along with longstanding practice, as this court discussed in Cedar Cove and as the U.S. Supreme Court discussed in Noel Canning, along with things like the purpose of the legislation. So I do agree that often that is where those sources, those tools of interpretation are coming into the mix. My point is only that we do think that the CJA expressly granted us this authority, so we certainly believe you could rule for us without reaching those extrinsic sources. But if you did think it was ambiguous, and here, at the very least, we think the legislature thought our reading was correct, but if you thought that you weren't sure if they were right or not, that would just be really good evidence that it's at least ambiguous and you should bring in all of those extrinsic sources.
I thought you were referencing Chapter 94 for a different purpose, which was not as legislative history or subsequent legislation that elucidates what the meaning of the CJA was when it was enacted, but instead as a very clear statement from the legislature that they believed, at least in this circumstance, that the Attorney General had the authority to supersede the Patterson Police Department, because otherwise they would not have said that. There would be no use for a statute that allowed a particular officer in charge to be maintained when the Attorney General has superseded a particular city in a particular instance if that was not allowed.
So I appreciate the question, Justice Wainwright, because it actually dovetails with what was going to be my second point to Justice Patterson, which is I think there are two ways that we're using Chapter 94. And the first is as evidence of legislative intent. And the second is as evidence of, you know, in a separation of powers case, which this fundamentally is, it's a question of whether an agency, as whether the executive branch overstepped its authority, its legislatively given authority. It's really, really good evidence that we're in that category where the executive branch is operating at its apex because it has the legislature on its side actually helping. That's what this court explained in Worthington versus Favre, and it cited the famous Justice Jackson concurrence in the Steele Caesars case that we all learn about in con law in law school. So I do think it absolutely also functions in that way too, Justice Wainwright, after both as evidence of legislative intent and as a sign of kind of confirmation, ratification, the branches working together, which means that to find a separation of powers violation, which is fundamentally what my friends on the other side are saying, they would need to meet the absolute highest bar, which I don't think they can.
In reference to the Attorney General's authority in general to supersede a police department, you mentioned the first prong of your argument was the text of the text and structure of the CJA. The text of the CJA in 17B-106, very specific. Whenever requested in writing by the governor, the attorney general shall, and whenever requested in writing by a grand jury or the board of chosen freeholders of a county, the attorney general may supersede the county prosecutors for the purpose of prosecuting all the criminal business. And then 17B-107, again, very specific. Whenever in the opinion of the attorney general, the interests of the state will be furthered by so doing, the attorney general may supersede a county prosecutor in any investigation, criminal action, or proceeding. None of the text of the CJA says anything about the attorney general's authority to supersede a police department or the county prosecutor's authority to supersede a police department. So how does the text of the CJA help you where it is very specific and does provide for supersession, just not of a local police department, seemingly? It only expressly references supersession by the attorney general of the county prosecutor.
Sure, Justice Wainwright, if I could answer that in a few different parts, because I think there are a few points that I want to make sure to make in response to that question. So the first is that where the CJA responds, you know, talks about supersession and uses the word county prosecutors, I think one fair reading and the reading that has been widely accepted for a really long time is that that incorporates by reference the corresponding authority that the county prosecutors have in turn over the municipal law enforcement. So.
But it doesn't actually say that. So it is very specific about specific instances in which the attorney general can supersede the county prosecutor. It doesn't actually say anything about the county prosecutor superseding a municipal police department. Correct?
So separately in 2A158-5, it says that the county prosecutors have the authority that the attorney general has within their specific counties. And courts have read that to basically mean that they operate, that the same thing is happening in a kind of a nested way within the counties for the attorney general. So when the attorney general, if the attorney general can supersede a county prosecutor and a county prosecutor can supersede municipally, it follows that attorney general can supersede municipal law enforcement directly. I also think that the CJA gives you a clue that it's thinking that way. It's a pretty strong clue in 112B when it makes clear that the duty to cooperate doesn't just run between the attorney general and the county prosecutor's office, but extends down to the third level of the pyramid where the police departments are obligated to follow orders from both the county prosecutors and the attorney general. So I think that's another source in this, and that's what I think of as more of a structural argument, but it is rooted in the text of 112B. And one more piece of text you have then in the CJA is Chapter 98, which of course establishes this comprehensive system of statewide oversight where the attorney general is the chief law enforcement officer of the state. And one reason that I think you know you can't read 107 to stop at the county level is that no one for decades, and I haven't heard my friends on the other side suggest, that the attorney general would be precluded if the Trenton police were doing an investigation of someone and they were going to interview a witness, but the New Jersey State Police or DCJ were also investigating this person. No one has ever argued, to my knowledge, that the attorney general couldn't say, we are taking over this investigation, we're going to have the state police do this witness interview, it's not going to be the Trenton police. Everyone has always understood that when 107 is giving that authority to the attorney general, it doesn't stop at the county level, it extends down to the municipal level. Again, I think 112B and 98 give you really strong textual evidence for that. Of course, Chapter 98 confirms that the more recent legislature understood it that way, as well as just numerous sources of contemporaneous construction by agency heads, our office, and other people appointed to serve at the helm of our office, and courts. Likewise, lots of judges have talked about that power extending down to the municipal level, even though in 107A, I agree that first sentence does say municipal prosecutor. And then last, Justice Wainwright, after
court cases, what is the best case for the authority that a county prosecutor can supersede a local police department without the local police department's consent or when they object.
So I don't know that they all, it's not teed up. So this is admittedly dicta. We've never argued it's not, but it's never teed up as a question of consent versus not. I think logic tells you it has to be absent consent because the very departments that are most going to be in need of supersession are going to be the ones least likely to consent. You take the example of Patterson, the mayor of Camden. The mayor of Camden was resistant to state involvement, was also being investigated for federal crimes, ended up going to prison on corruption charges for crimes that were being committed actively in that time. So it's not, it's a very odd construction of the power to say that you need the local government that might be the ones responsible for how much the uniformity of criminal justice has broken down, how much the efficiency of criminal justice has broken down, have to sign off for the state to come in.
Counselor, before you go,
and just to sum up, I appreciate you walking through all the different statutes. I think you would probably agree it's probably an overstatement. I think earlier in your argument, you said that the CJA expressly gives the Attorney General's office the authority to supersede a police department. I don't know if you meant the plain language clearly of the CJA clearly gives that authority. I think that would be an overstatement.
So Justice Pierre-Louis, I don't mean to get caught up, I guess, on the labels of, we think of it as an express delegation. I do think that when you read the plain language in context, when you look at all of the different pieces of the CJA together, it leaves you with that impression and you don't need to reach the question of whether it's implied. We do also think it's very strongly implied, even if it's not expressly granted. So I'm not here saying you have to say it's express versus implied. Our point is simply that we think when you read the CJA, all of it together, the way this court has told us to read statutes, when you look at it against the backdrop of longstanding history as understood by lower court decisions, and Justice Wainwright, I'll come back to my favorite lower court decisions, when you look at the subsequent legislative history, when you look at the purposes of the CJA to make sure that the public has confidence in law enforcement and that law enforcement is operating in a way that is uniform, so that people understand that the way you're getting policed in Patterson is fundamentally the same as the way you're getting policed in Parsippany, that all of those tools of legislative intent point in the same direction.
So why did the legislature see fit in Section 106 to identify a particular category of supersession, and that's the Attorney General may supersede the county prosecutor for the purpose of prosecuting all the criminal business, et cetera, if the totem pole of authority in criminal justice in New Jersey and general practice are enough? In other words, if your argument is that the Attorney General has inherent authority because the Attorney General is a senior law enforcement officer, has very broad authority in law enforcement, it has inherent authority to take whatever action it needs to, he in this case determines that he needs to take in order to establish uniformity. Why was it necessary for the legislature to identify a particular category of supersession and expressly give that authority?
So you're talking about Section 106 specifically?
106, and in specific, the line, the clause about supersession of the county prosecutor.
So I think what 106 is doing, I think it's important to read it in historical context. And this is where a case that I think the PBA cites, it's a 1957 case, Morse versus Forbes, is actually very illustrative because it shows that between 1947 and the ratification of our current constitution and the CJA in 1970, there was some question about exactly how much power from the common law and exactly the scope of power that the Attorney General had as a supervisory officer over the county and municipal levels of law enforcement. On the one hand, you had cases like State versus Wynn, where Chief Justice Vanderbilt himself said that the county prosecutor can call everyone down to the chancemen on his beat into service and make them do basically whatever he thinks is in the public interest.
Out of curiosity, I was reading that over the weekend. What is a chanceman?
I had the same question. I think it'd be the patrolman, Justice Patterson. It's like my answer to Chief Justice Rather. I can't swear as an officer of the court, but it is my understanding it's the patrolman. I had the same question.
didn't, the definition of the dictionary didn't quite fit that. But anyway,
I agree with you. It's a potential line edit for Chief Justice Vanderbilt. But I that was some people's understanding of the. Of the powers that the Attorney General retained, but it wasn't everyone's. And Morris versus Forbes actually lays out that at the time, supersession was not something, or in 57, there were some people who thought that the Attorney General could not supersede, basically, you know, when the interest of justice required. In fact, the people who could were the Board of Freeholders and the assignment judge. And so what's interesting about 106 is in 1970, the legislature speaks to this. It reestablishes and confirms, and I think even enhances to some degree, the powers that the Attorney General has in our state as a policy choice to enable a particularly integrated form of supervision of criminal justice. Again, they didn't have to do that. Other states have different choices, but that is the choice they made. And one of the reasons I think they wrote 106.
In 106, it's not actually the Attorney General's discretionary choice, right? I thought it's only whenever requested in writing by the governor or shall, and then whenever requested in writing by a grand jury or the Board of Chosen Freeholders or the assignment judge. So that makes sense, given the history that you just said, may. It never says the Attorney General can decide on his own without the governor, without the grand jury, without the Board of Chosen Freeholders, or without the assignment judge.
What I think is happening there, what's happening in 106, it then in the same section 106 goes on to say, under those circumstances, the Attorney General may supersede any individual case all the way down to the individual case. And then in 107, it comes back and says he can also do that whenever in the interest of justice it requires. And the way you know that I think 106 is just making clear that the Attorney General no longer has to follow orders from the assignment judge or the Board of Freeholders is that second clause or that later clause in 106 about superseding each individual case is total surplusage against 107A1, which is saying the exact same thing. So I think 106 is saying when the governor tells you to do it, you have to. Any other important people who used to be able to control you can't control you anymore, but you can do it if they ask you. But if they tell you to do it, you can say, I'm going to decide for myself. And then 107 says you can do it whenever the interests of justice so require. And I think what that's incorporating basically is the purposes of the CJA, which are popular confidence in law enforcement, uniformity, efficiency in criminal justice.
107 is restricted to investigation of proceeding only, not superseding the county prosecutor in all of its roles, correct?
Well, I think what follows from that, and the reason you have this longstanding practice and understanding that supersession is permissible, is that any piece of individual work that a local agency is doing can mean all of those pieces at once if the circumstances warrant.
But then shouldn't it have said supersede a county prosecutor? I know you're relying on the word any a lot, but shouldn't it have said then in any investigations, criminal actions, or proceedings, plural? It is singular. It does specifically in 107 talk only about superseding a county prosecutor in any investigation, criminal action, or proceeding, singular.
I, Justice Wainwright, I don't think the singular plural would change because of what any's doing there. It's like if you say the CEO can remove any member of the executive team at any time in the corporation, that means that the CEO can remove all of them at once. It wouldn't need to say any executives versus executive. I think the meaning would be the same.
Okay, where would I go if I wanted to find whatever criteria or threshold or factors that the Attorney General is using to supersede the county prosecutor and or a local police department?
I think that the interests that the CJA itself identifies at its core are where you would look. Again, I think Section 98 itself gives you what I read to be the three main purposes of the act, which are popular confidence in criminal justice throughout our state, uniformity, so that the way we're doing law enforcement in one town is not wildly different than the way it's happening right across the border, and the efficient administration of justice, which I take to mean ensuring that public safety is actually being protected, that people are effectively and making sure that the laws are being followed. I think those are the three.
So if there is an argument that the Attorney General acted in an arbitrary fashion, what judicial recourse is there?
So Justice Hoffman, I think that you would bring an arbitrary and capricious challenge if a town believed that an Attorney General or a county prosecutor had superseded on an unreasonable basis, an arbitrary or capricious basis, an unreasonable basis, a discriminatory basis. I think you would bring an arbitrary and capricious challenge in the appellate division if it's the attorney general, and you would say, I understand, you know, you have this authority, but you've used it in a way that is impermissible because basic principles of agency action take this choice off the table. You said that things are going really badly here, but here's all our evidence that things are going really well here. Or you said that we have all of these problems, but here's our evidence that we don't have any of these problems. Or why did you think we had these problems? And then you could have a fact-specific dispute about whether that particular supersession was in fact justified. Here, this of course comes to you just as a threshold legal question. Could any attorney general under any circumstances ever exercise this power? That's what their challenge was, not you picked the wrong city. And I think to their credit, they've never argued that this was somehow unreasonable or that we had bad motives for it. They just said, sorry, the power doesn't exist at all. Of course, we disagree and we think the power does exist. But so this is the legal version of that. But in some future case, if an attorney general was, you know, doing something crazy, just flipping a coin or, you know, superseded because it's Tuesday, of course, would seem like a very strong arbitrary and capricious challenge.
Counsel, is the precise text of the CJA your strongest argument, or is it the fact that you see in Chapter 94 the legislature validating, the legislature then appropriating funds? How would you help us out in terms of the arguments you're most heavily relying upon?
So, Chief Justice Radner, I don't think of my arguments in necessarily that ranking. I think that collectively it's an easy case because we have a lot of strong arguments that point in the same direction. So I do think that the text of the CJA itself has been read this way for a really long time. And to Justice Wehner after, I'll mention some cases like I think it was Justice Skillman or Judge Skillman's decision in a case called Garofsi. There's a footnote from Judge Sabatino in Williams. There's a Judge Masano.
The first case one more time.
It's Garofsi versus Passaic County Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. It's 376 NJ Super 405. It's a Judge Skillman opinion from 2005. There's a Judge Masano opinion from 2009, Constantine versus Township of Bass River, 406 NJ Super 305.
But these are all statements. Nothing is a holding, correct?
I agree. These are all just, this is just evidence of how everyone read the text, which is just my, or how many, many learned people read the text in response to Chief Justice Radner's question, that I don't think the text of the CJA, I do think the text of the CJA is good for us, but if you had doubts about the text of the CJA and the structure it sets up, which really can't function as a meaningful three-level hierarchy, if the Chief of Chiefs can't more directly supervise county and local operations at a more holistic level when things warrant it, when more than just one case deserves it. I think that plus the subsequent legislative action, the you know, Chapter 94, which expressly shows the legislature intended for this supersession to be valid, the appropriations for this very supersession repeatedly now, I think all of those pieces of evidence taken collectively compel the conclusion that the attorney general was acting pursuant to a legislative authorization when he superseded the Patterson Police Department.
The appellate division, and I'm just asking you whether you agree with this or disagree with it, the appellate division in discussing Directive 2022-14 about transparency in IA investigations stated that since the directive was adopted, I presume in 2022, the legislature has not expressly authorized the OAG's unilateral extension of its supersession powers beyond the scope of the CJA or and in combination with 40A-14-181, which the appellate division viewed as an IA only statute. Do you agree with that statement by the appellate division?
I disagree with it, Justice Patterson. I disagree with it chiefly because you have Chapter 94, which is passed again after that change to the IAPP has been made. And I think it was in 2022 for sure.
Do you view Chapter 94 as an express authorization of the OAG's unilateral, I'm using the language, it's in the appellate division, extension of its supersession powers.
I view it as
opposed to an endorsement or an implicit authorization.
I want to make sure I'm understanding the label that we're using there, because I guess I view it as both of those things. I mean, I do view it as endorsing, blessing this particular supersession, but I also think it reflects this longstanding understanding that the CJA does confer this ability on the Office of the Attorney General and the Office of the County Prosecutor within their respective counties. And we think that change to the IAPP, confirms that reflects that. We then, of course, did supersede the Patterson Police Department. And then after hearing testimony about that very supersession, the legislature passes a law that confirms there are situations where the Attorney General can supersede a municipal police department. And when he does so, the legislature wanted to make sure that it was actually slightly easier for that supersession to succeed, not just through being able to appoint the person who you think is the best candidate for officer in charge, even if they're an experienced law enforcement officer from out of state as opposed to in state, but also then, of course, appropriating funds repeatedly, millions of dollars, after hearing testimony about this very supersession and why the funds were needed.
But in terms of ratifying the AG's authority for all time, not just in that particular circumstance, it seems that the language of Chapter 94 works against that, because it specifically says this act shall take effect immediately, shall be retroactive to March 1, 2023, and shall expire upon the termination of the period of time during which the law enforcement agency in a city of the first class having a population of less than 200,000, according to the 2020 decennial census, is superseded by the Attorney General. So it very much seems to be confined to the particular instance that the legislature was referring to here that started on March 2023 and was going to expire at some point, and was not a ratification of the Attorney General's broad authority to supersede any municipal police department for all time and in any circumstance.
So, Justice Wainwright, I think it is. It does count for more than just that. I don't think it operates only as a ratification or endorsement of this particular supersession, though I think it does that as at a minimum. But what I think that expiration is doing is saying that the kind of pilot program of hiring an officer in charge from outside New Jersey and then allowing them to do their police training and licensing in a more flexible way, that relaxation of the rules for police licensing is not going to last forever. That's the thing that ends when the law ends. The law continues to serve as evidence of the legislature's understanding that supersession authority exists, even if in 2 years you wouldn't be able to hire an officer in charge from out of state and have them do their training at in Trenton or in Patterson, as opposed to going to the DCJ Academy at Seeger, which is practically what that law is accomplishing. It's making it slightly easier for officer in charge.
How far does it extend? Could the AG decide tomorrow to supersede any municipal police department in the state as to which there had been a suggestion or a complaint of financial mismanagement or use of excessive force on citizens, or some other inappropriate police conduct as a category of municipal police departments that can be superseded?
Justice Patterson, I think the more, the hypos became indiscriminate, the more you would get back to my colloquy with Justice Hoffman, which was that you would draw arbitrary and capricious challenges. And while it's impossible to say how any particular one would fare, I think.
As a general proposition, though, does it allow the AG to supersede multiple police departments? Because in the judgment and obviously experience of the AG, there is something inappropriate, I'm trying to be as broad as possible, in the AG's view that requires supersession.
I think the inappropriateness would have to be in some way tethered to the goals of the Criminal Justice Act. I think that still operates
broad. Obviously. So the two examples I came up with just sitting here, financial mismanagement and use of excessive force, clearly within, you could have all kinds of types of misconduct or inappropriate conduct that would, I think, arguably fit under the general purposes of CJA. So where are the lines that can be drawn? I know you're saying somebody would bring an arbitrary and capricious challenge, it would go to the appellate division, might end up here, but you're here telling us that there is this authority. How far does it go?
So, Justice Patterson, again, the way I think in a, I would, in a future case, or if this court is trying to give guidance to future courts applying to this, I do think we have argued already that past history and practice are probative to understanding the scope of this authority. And that past history and practice itself tells you that this is a tool that is used on a fairly limited basis. It's twice in our history have attorneys general done it with respect to a municipal police department.
Once should, should it be used on a limited basis?
I hesitate to say something or to bind a future attorney general as to if you had a situation where you had a crisis in a cluster of towns. I just don't want to say anything that would mean that there's some you know, magic words that would somehow prevent some sort of action. But I do think that past practice is probative here. And so generally speaking, this is not something you see attorneys general you know, do lightly. It's no attorney general wants to do this. It's something that twice in our history an attorney general thought it was compelled, you know, basically more morally compelled, at least, to take some kind of action. You've seen approximately, we found about 17 examples of county prosecutors doing it over, you know, about 25 years. So again, in a state of 564 municipalities, that's about once a year you get a situation where it's there's a serious enough problem that it justifies it. So I do think the courts would—
Speaking about that, and since the APTIV here said that neither party contested the proposition that county prosecutors have the supervisory authority to supersede the day-to-day operations of municipal police departments. I tried to look in the briefing to find a specific concession by Patterson that county prosecutors have the supervisory authority to do so, and I didn't see anything. Are you aware of a specific concession, or was this the APTIV? Did it come up at oral argument before the appellate division? Where did the appellate division get that this was not contested?
So I don't recall. I mean, I'll obviously let my friends on the other side answer for themselves, but I don't recall them arguing at oral argument that there was a problem with the I thought they tried to distinguish the history of counties doing this as saying that's different because the counties could somehow have this power if the attorney general doesn't. And of course, we disagree completely. We don't think the legal logic holds there because 2A 158-5 tells you that the county prosecutors have exactly the power that the attorney general has within their respective counties. And so if the attorney general can't do it, then the county prosecutors can't do it. And if the county prosecutors can do it, it only follows that the attorney general can do it. So everyone, I think there has been, was an argument, and the appellate division embraced it, that you could somehow leave those cases for another day. But our position is you can't leave those cases for another day because there is no logical way to separate out whether an attorney general and a county prosecutor can do it.
You're relying on statutory, not constitutional authority. So if the legislature thought that an attorney general was acting too frequently, too broadly in exercising authority, it could articulate standards and make it very clear in another statute. No?
That's exactly right, Chief Justice Ratner. Again, this is only a case about legislative intent. Here we have the trajectory of legislative, you know, the legislature's feelings about this power only run in a positive direction for us, which is that since 1970, you have more centralization and more, you know, delegation of authority to the attorney general to oversee and comprehensively regulate law enforcement at the local level. That includes the IAPP statute from 1996, 4814-181. It includes, of course, some other statutes that are the former attorneys general cite in their brief talking about this general movement. And then, of course, Chapter 94 confirms that if the legislature had any concerns about the attorney general's possession of this power or use of its power, of course, it could have passed a law right there reining it in or saying you can't do this. Instead, they did the opposite, which they said, we're going to make it easier for you to succeed. And in addition, we're going to appropriate $10 million for you to be able to, you know, hopefully transform policing in Patterson. And that's really, really strong evidence. And that's where I think, again, another tool of legislative interpretation is longstanding legislative acquiescence. It tells you that our reading is the right one, because if the legislature had felt our reading was the wrong one, they would have told us to knock it off. And instead, they partnered with us and helped support this particular supersession.
Have there been any other supersessions since March 1st of 2023 by the Attorney General?
By the Attorney General, no. There was a...
Of a local police department with a population of less than 200,000.
Not of a city of the first class. There is the Clark Township Police Department was superseded for a number of years. That supersession has recently ended. It was technically under the Union County Prosecutor's Office. But it is a supersession of the Municipal Police Department. But it was.
I'm asking solely about the Attorney General.
No, Your Honor. The only one is the Patterson supersession.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add at this point?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Patel. I'm going to try to get your argument in so that we have a time for a break for lunch and then turn to the other side.
Completely understand. I will try to be quick. May it please the court. As has been discussed, this case is about statutory construction. Like the OAG, Amici contends that the AG does have the power through the tenets of statutory construction to supersede municipal police departments. And I won't repeat what Mr. Zuckerman argued so thoroughly, but I wanted to highlight one important thing. This case is also about a real community in Patterson, in which Black and Brown residents have been plagued by years of police misconduct. They deserve accountability, and that's what's on the line in this matter. These are not separate issues, neither in this case nor in terms of legislative policy. As I said, I won't repeat Mr. Zuckerman, but I wanted to lay out 3 points today that I think support his argument and to legislative intent here. First, the legislative intent behind the Criminal Justice Act of 1970 and its progeny is to, among other things, empower the chief law enforcement officer of the state, the AG, to exercise his power to rebuild public trust. Second, this is exemplified by the legislature's inaction when their attention was called to the AG's ability to supersede when they passed Chapter 94 and twice appropriated funds for the supersession. Third, there is no better option than supersession available for people in Patterson, particularly its Black and Brown communities, to have recourse or accountability for the harms they have endured. To my first point, this court has held for decades, to quote the State Department of Civil Service v. Clark, that as between the two possible constructions of the statute, the one should be adopted, which effectuates rather than defeats the legislative purpose. Moreover, practical and contemporaneous constructions of a statute are key extrinsic aids to its construction. In the Criminal Justice Act of 1970, the legislature explicitly named the Attorney General as chief law enforcement officer of the state. The reason for this act, which must be liberally construed, was that circumstances had brought, and I quote, about a loss of popular confidence in the agencies of government, end quote. Patterson is a clear example of a city where there has been a breakdown and loss of public trust, mainly due to the actions of the police department. Patterson is less than 25% Black, but Black people account for 52% of police use of force incidents. These aren't just statistics, though all of this is well documented. This is about real people with names. Those names are Najee Seabrooks, Jameek Lowry, Felix De Jesus, and so many others. There have been multiple lawsuits, multiple officers indicted, supervisors who falsified reports, and through all of this, no meaningful change until the AG stepped in. Given the issues in Patterson, the AG appropriately exercised his authority as chief law enforcement officer when he did so. This was the appropriate action, not just in the AG or in the Abiki's opinion, but in the legislature's opinion, given that it passed Chapter 94 right after the AG's supersession, which leads to my second point. While legislative inaction cannot always be relied upon, it is given weight when, like here, a legislature has taken action on a statute and where a practical and contemporaneous interpretation was called to its attention, but the legislature failed to change that interpretation. During the committee hearings regarding Chapter 94, the AG's representative repeatedly shared that the reason they were asking for special consideration of the AG's choice or officer in charge was to bring the community and police back together, that relations needed to be rebuilt. I'll also note, and I think Chief Justice Ravner, this goes to one of your earlier questions about the budget process and what it meant. I'm not sure, and I think Mr. Zuckerman's looking into the specific allocation in the budget documents themselves, but I will add that during the budget hearings, the AG specifically discussed Patterson. And the budget chair in the Senate, at least, had a whole conversation with him and said a couple of times, I hope you'll stay as long as necessary to rebuild confidence with residents and address some of the high crime areas regarding Patterson.
And towards the end, he said, I welcome the state police's involvement in Patterson, and I know this committee will be supportive of providing the resources needed. This is because the legislature always intended the AG to have this authority to try to address situations like here in Patterson, where there is a breakdown of community trust. I'll also note, Chief Justice Ravner, you had a question about if the legislature thought at any given time the AG was not using this power enough or using it too often, they could say so, they could act. I agree. They certainly can. If the legislature believes the AG, the Attorney General, is overstepping and superseding too often or not often enough, they certainly can have. And in fact, they have in a similar situation. In 2019, the legislature passed what is colloquially called the Independent Prosecutor Law. It is Section 107. Subsection 2 or 107 and 107.1 of the Criminal Justice Act. In those instances, in that law, they said when there is a police involved killing, the Attorney General must step in, shall step in to supersede that investigation. This was over the Attorney General's objection. They passed it. Why? Because when you have a killing at the hands of a police officer, public trust breaks down. And the legislature recognized that we needed someone else to step in for accountability purposes. So in that situation, for example, the AG wasn't exercising this power. He did have this authority, but the legislature disagreed and said, no, you have to in these instances.
Ms. Patel, do you have a citation for the comments earlier you quoted from the budget chair?
It is in the budget hearing process. I don't know if it was actually quoted. I apologize. It's in the legislative history, and we can provide a submission, but it is in the Senate Budget and Appropriations hearings for April 4th, 2023 at 10:30 a.m. And the quotes I gave were in minutes 26:27 to 27:50. Yes. This leads me to my final point. There is no better option, unfortunately, available for here for Black and Brown communities in Patterson, or indeed for communities throughout the state. While the DOJ can investigate municipal police departments and enforce compliance with federal law through consent decrees, this intervention, while often impactful, often takes years, can be unpredictable, and is subject to political whim. Federal intervention in Newark has led to real progress in rebuilding community trust in the city. However, the process took years, decades even, before it began. During that time, the Newark Police Department had a long pattern and practice of misconduct, specifically towards Newark's Black and Brown residents. But it's not just time, it's political reality. Different administrations have taken different stances on investigations and consent decrees for municipal police departments. The DOJ released its report on its investigation into the Trenton Police Department in November 2024, finding a pattern and practice of misconduct at the hands of the police. However, it is unclear whether this will lead to a consent decree anytime soon. To conclude, I'd like to reiterate that the legislative intent here was to provide the AG with broad powers to rebuild public trust, including supersession powers, and New Jersey's AG properly exercised that power. However, I want to emphasize the stakes here. If this court were to affirm the appellate division's opinion, the people of Patterson, especially its Black and Brown residents, will be left without justice and public trust would remain broken. Unless there's any further questions.
Thank you.